From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from San Leandro.
I'm living in Richmond.
Vallejo.
San Jose.
Oakland.
West Oakland.
Coming up, we'll see how San Francisco's main library is addressing issues with its homeless patrons.
I checked the bathrooms out, trying to get people to comply with library rules, like don't wash your hair in the bathroom sink.
Then we'll walk inside libraries undergoing a transformation that doesn't necessarily involve books.
The mission related to knowledge and community is broader than books.
And we talk about some of the constraints that are still being placed on young women.
We are really raised to be fearful and not to see ourselves as brave or adventurous.
Changing libraries and unchanging stereotypes. Today on Cross Currents, stay with us. Almost half of the homeless in San Francisco say the main reason they don't have a permanent residence is because they can't afford rent. One place homeless people have found is San Francisco's main library, where many gather outside and inside when it's open. In the past few years, the library has taken a unique approach to helping its many homeless patrons. KALW's Julia Scott has more in this story from our archives.
It's almost done. A few more minutes.
A medley of people wait for the library to open in the morning. Students on a deadline, people who really need a library book, retired folks, and people checking email.
Well, it's time, so let them in.
And then over there, they also come in.
Let them in.
As the doors open, patrons stream into the atrium at the main branch of the San Francisco Public Library. Some head to their favorite reading nook, others to computers to start surfing the web.
Third floor. Please turn right. Going down.
The library is by nature a transitory place. Most people come and go. But Craig, who didn't want his last name used, is usually here all day. Craig is homeless, and like thousands of other homeless, he comes to the library when he has nowhere else to go.
It's one of the few buildings that's open almost 7 days a week, and thank God for Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday when it's open until 8.
Craig sits in a sunny room and reads the newspaper. He eats some bread and bananas. If he's bored, he dozes off.
I come to the library basically because it's quiet and it's clean. It also doesn't have the atmosphere that a lot of the drop-in centers have. A lot of the drop-in centers, you just feel like you are homeless.
San Francisco's public library system has become known for its digital innovations, special collections, and reading events. The Civic Center branch has also become known, for better or worse, as a homeless hangout. And that prompted a new kind of innovation.
I'd never been homeless up until 3 months ago, so this is a new experience for me.
What started as a tough situation, staff members worried about people washing up in the bathrooms or acting badly, turned into an opportunity. The library, which has always thought of itself as a resource, found it had nothing to offer people who came in asking for help finding housing or places to sleep. The city's solution? Bring in a social worker assigned to deal with the needs of homeless folks. That's how, in 2009, Leah Esquerra became the first homeless social worker in the country based out of a library.
What I've learned from being here is that the library's goal is to include everybody, to make the library accessible for everybody, and not to screen anybody out.
Esquerra says the goal has been to help its homeless patrons and to make the library safer.
Having a library, it's the true mark of democracy in a country, and democracy meaning that you include everybody.
Since the program's inception 3 years ago, Esquerra has reached out to nearly 1,200 homeless people at the library and referred them to city services. So far, 74 of them have also found housing. Esquerra doesn't advertise her services. Instead, she relies on her outreach workers, also known as health and safety associates. Kathleen, who didn't want her last name used, is one of them.
I hang out in the library, I check the bathrooms out, trying to get people to comply with library rules, like don't wash your hair in the bathroom sink and that kind of stuff. But the bigger picture is to give them options.
Just a few years ago, Kathleen was also homeless at the library. She used to be a house painter in Sacramento. Then the recession hit.
October 31st, 2008 was the last day I worked, and Lehman Brothers had just crashed, and it was just like the light switch. Somebody flipped it off and there was no more work. Just stopped.
Kathleen and her partner lost their house and started living in their car in San Francisco. When the car broke down, they spent rainy days drying off at the Mission Branch Library. Eventually, some homeless outreach workers found them and helped them get back on their feet.
It was my time to accept help. So everybody in their lives will have that time. They will, you know, hold out the hand. And if we can just be there, then that's a hand up.
Did you check to make sure all the desks are inside?
According to the National Coalition for the Homeless, more than 3.5 million Americans may be homeless on a given night. And libraries across the country have become a destination for the poor and homeless to seek help with everything from finding a job to finding a place to sleep. Jill Bourne is San Francisco's deputy city librarian.
This question is always huge in urban libraries around how much should a library take on of the homeless problem? Having the program in whole is helping. The bigger social issue is still looming, and that's the bigger challenge.
Hundreds of city libraries across the country, including San Francisco, have tried to address that bigger social issue by opening job centers and adding resume workshops. The city's social worker program has become a national model. Sacramento now has a homeless outreach worker on call at the Central Library. San Jose's MLK Junior Library brings social workers and lawyers in for free. But just as the role of the library has evolved to meet the needs of a population in peril, the group of people who need help has widened too. Social worker Leah Esguerra says she sees students who have defaulted on their school loans and are living in their cars.
I've seen families displaced as well, the same situation. They lost their jobs, they lost their homes, they went through their savings, and now where do we go?
May I have your attention, please? The library will be closing in 15 minutes.
At the end of the day, the library isn't just a place to read. It's an urban destination and a sanctuary. And for 600 homeless folks each year, it's also a safety net. In San Francisco, I'm Julia Scott for Cross Currents.
That story originally aired in 2012. Since then, Jill Bourne has become the San Jose Library Director. Leah Esguerra is still in her same role in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. So what exactly defines a library? In the days of the Library of Alexandria, libraries stored ancient knowledge and words were kept on pages of papyrus. Books became the primary product until the past few decades. But today, you can use your library card to check out electronic games and stream videos. Some cities even lend out construction equipment, have seed exchanges, and host yoga classes. Reporter Holly J. McDeed has the story of what it means to be a library today and where the books fit in.
Libraries are usually quiet, but Berkeley Library Board of Trustees meetings can get pretty darn loud.
If this is where the library's going, I'm desperate. They now bore me and terrify me.
That's from a meeting held after the Berkeley Public Library director decided to remove thousands of books from the shelves. In the library world, that's actually called book weeding. Books that hadn't been checked out for 3 years were removed. And that did not sit well with some Berkeley residents.
We deserve better than that. Berkeley does, our kids do, the country does.
Since then, the Berkeley Library director resigned, a new director was appointed, and book weeding was put on pause. But this flare-up raised the question for Berkeley Library that many others have had to wrestle with. What is the purpose of a library? Well, at least in the beginning, it was, quote,
having nothing in view but the good of mankind.
That's the Redwood Library's guiding principle. It's said to be the first lending library in America, officially opened in 1750. And maintaining the good of mankind to this library meant lots of books. They stocked books on beekeeping, lantern building, and cider making. And for over a century, a library was defined by books, as helpfully demonstrated by Cookie Monster.
Me want a book about Little Red Riding Hood.
All right.
And one box of cookies, please.
Maybe you don't understand. You see, this is a library.
Yeah?
Yes, we have books here. Only books.
But that's not the case today at the San Francisco Public Library. In 2014, only 10% of the library's budget went to books. Like in Berkeley, some library goers are mad about the way this library treats books.
There's a symbolism to where the books are located, as far as I'm concerned, and that is they are pushed to the very periphery of the building.
Peter Warfield started a group called the Library Users Association in protest in the 90s after thousands of library books were tossed when the new main branch of the San Francisco Public Library was built. He tries to show me an article about that in an old New Yorker, but we can't find it. Many of the bound periodicals were moved to make room for a new literacy and learning center, much to Warfield's dismay. He doesn't appreciate the other things the library offers, like a social worker to help the many homeless visitors, or job services.
For people to get a job, why don't they provide telephones? Why don't they provide a haberdashery where people could get a suit and a tie and a white shirt and a nice pair of shoes? There's a lot that could be done, but it's not the mission of the library.
Peter Warfield believes the library's mission should be to provide reading material, period, end of story. Teen librarian Mary Obler sees it differently.
What we're doing here at The Mix is really just a first step of a whole evolution of how libraries are growing.
The Mix is the library's teen center, located on the second floor of the public library's main branch. It opened last summer. That's from the audio production studio inside The Mix. At The Mix, teens can make music, learn to code, and even make things with a 3D printer. Obler tells me that lots of teens who come here don't like reading, and that's not so bad.
All of the things that we provide through our programming, be it video production or music making or poetry or 2D animation or 3D printing, is all engaging kids on different levels of literacies.
She says the Teen Center is attracting people who would never otherwise set foot in a library at all, like teenager Lauren Ng.
What kind of books do you like to read?
I don't like reading books.
But she does like The Mix. Lots of teens do, not just for the music labs or 3D printers, but as a place to just hang out, which is exactly what Obler and the library want.
What we are hoping to do is to create a space where you can, of course, continue to do that, but also where you can maybe learn collaboratively and be exposed to different ways of thinking. I feel like, yeah, this is kind of a big trend and evolution of the way libraries are going.
Well, actually, libraries have been collaborative spaces for a long time, like the Mechanics Institute Library and Chess Room in downtown San Francisco.
It was founded when the gold rush was coming to an end and people were trying to reimagine, you know, how they create a sense of community and how they rebuild a society that was really suffering.
That's Ralph Lewin, the executive director for the Mechanics Institute, one of the oldest libraries on the West Coast. He explains that in those days, a mechanic could be anyone who made something. Poets, for instance, could be mechanics. The Mechanics Institute was formed as a place where people could exchange ideas, collaborate, and learn mechanical arts.
So I think what we're seeing is, at least for the Mechanics Institute, we've seen a return to those original values and mission.
It's still a collaborative space, but with a different audience. Tech workers and book lovers mingle over tables, and different San Francisco literary organizations rent rooms from the Institute.
There's value in books, but the mission related to knowledge and community is broader than books. Thinking about how we can best be places where people come together and learn and access information and knowledge, that's broader than books.
So, what is a library? Opinions differ greatly. Some people think libraries should be the bookkeepers. For others, they're a space to be loud and play with 3D printers. Some just want a space to meet and collaborate with other people. What's clear is that libraries, whether focused on books or not, continue to be important spaces for people who want to learn.
There's always going to be a role for libraries as long as they continue to serve that hunger.
Hungry for books, or?
Me want book about cookies.
Fine, that we have, a book about cookies. Good.
And a glass of milk, please.
Anything's possible in the library. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. According to a recent study, parents are 4 times more likely to tell girls to be careful than boys. Whether we like it or not, many still believe that our daughters are more fragile emotionally and physically than our sons. But San Francisco author Caroline Paul hopes to lead by example. She's flown planes, rafted rivers, climbed mountains, and was one of the first women to join the San Francisco Fire Department. Now she's written a book she hopes girls all over the country will check out from their libraries. It's called Gutsy Girl: Escapes for Your Life of Epic Adventure. It includes thrilling stories from girls and women throughout history and some of her own, too. And it encourages a new generation of girls to conquer fears and lead lives that are gutsy and fun. She sat down with KELW's Nina Gensler-Debs.
So tell me why you decided to write this book.
You know, I decided to write this book because I really saw that a lot of my female peers were pretty fearful. And I've been noticing that for a long time. I mean, I used to be a whitewater rafter, and I started on an easy river called the American River. And it was basically 50-50 women to men. And then as you got to the harder rivers, there just weren't that many women. It was mostly men. And it didn't make sense to me. Because running rivers takes, yeah, you have to be fit, but it really takes guts and it takes smarts. So why weren't women there? And I just think that it started to occur to me that we are really raised to be fearful and not to see ourselves as brave or adventurous.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think right now we think we're protecting our girls when we tell them to be careful or watch out. And it's really interesting because we don't do that with boys, and we want to protect them too in life. But we think we're girding them for life when we give them instructions when they're kids on how to do things on their own and face their trepidations. But with girls, we're not doing that. We're actually cautioning them, and we're telling them to be careful, and we're warning them away from things, and we're actually sort of instilling fear as opposed to bravery. Studies have shown that moms and dads have the same bias about their daughters, which is that their daughters are more fragile and less able than their sons. And this shows up in studies where they look at the way parents deal with boys and girls on playground equipment. So pretty young age. Girls and boys are actually physically the same up until they're about 11. If not, girls are ahead in terms of strength and maturity and dealing with things. So I started to really wonder, like, why are we using fear to allegedly, like, guide our girls?
So one of the things I really like about the book is that you distinguish between gutsiness and recklessness.
Yeah, I had a lot of trouble realizing that recklessness was not at all being sort of a good adventurer. It was basically just being stupid. And you can see that in some of my adventures. And the one that I use as an example is when I went with my friend Lars. He was sort of my mentor as a paraglider. And I wanted to impress him, as everybody did. And I went thermal flying, and he was sort of teaching me how to do that. But because he was very skilled at this, he didn't give me very good instructions. And I didn't really ask for them. So that was my bad, because I was just swaggering like, yeah, no problem. Pretty much within the hour, I had picked a thermal that rocketed me into a thundercloud. And I knew what could happen once everything started to mist over and I was still rising in my paraglider, that basically I was going to be caught in a storm. The oxygen would disappear. I would pass out. My paraglider would be ripped to shreds and I would die because I had heard about it. I got myself out of that storm cloud before all that happened, obviously. But I was really ashamed and humiliated that I had made such a bad mistake. And I did not, when I landed, tell Lars. And he said, hey, I don't want to really freak you out, but I saw this guy get cloud sucked. But he got out. Boy, was he stupid, but he was brave. And I thought, oh, Lars thinks he was brave. So then I confessed. And Lars was so angry at me. And I realized, oh, yeah, you know, being ballsy is not being a great adventurer.
I am here with Caroline Paul. We are speaking about The Gutsy Girl, Escapades for Your Life of Epic Adventure, which is a handbook to doing all things gutsy for girls. You make very clear that adventuring and being gutsy isn't something that just comes naturally to many people.
Well, you know, studies show that girls underestimate their abilities. And you know, boys maybe tend to overestimate. And so I really want girls to see that bravery and adventure is totally open to them. And the great thing is that bravery is learned. And like anything learned, it has to be practiced. And so I do have an exercise in there called micro bravery, which is when you just challenge yourself to do small acts of bravery. Because the thing about fear is it's very similar to excitement. It feels physically similar. So if you haven't trained yourself, you can be in a situation where you're on your bike as a kid, looking down a big hill, and you think you're scared, but you're not. You're actually just excited and nervous, but it's well within your ability. And so practicing bravery will make you just understand yourself so much better.
I don't think you demonize it in any ways, but you definitely reference a couple of times like get off the couch, turn off the TV, less screen time, and get outside. There's a very like sort of physical aspect to it. And obviously, you seem like a huge outdoors person.
Yeah, I think it's so important that girls actually get outside and be adventurous. Even though I do talk about learning bravery as something that, of course, is applicable across the board. And if you turn out to be somebody who isn't that into the outdoors, I'm not saying you're not gutsy. And I'm also not saying you have to be outdoors in order to have a happy life. But I am saying the outdoors is so fun. And it's an antidote to these pressures that I think girls have always felt to be pretty and be perfect. And in the outdoors, you can't be that. I mean, being pretty is irrelevant and isn't going to happen. And being liked is not the major thing. It's being a good teammate, you know, being a good adventure buddy. And being perfect, impossible.
Can you give us like, some examples of way that you can practice and demonstrate micro bravery and confidence and even adventure in your own life, sort of more day to day?
Yeah, I, you know, a lot of these adventures do take place, and I mean, some of them take place in exotic places, like in Siberia or on the top of Denali. But I want to be very clear that that's just because it's fun to read about. Like, adventure really happens often close to home. And we do have an illustration there about signs are on an adventure, and it's like, oh, you've said wow 10 times, or someone's used the word quest, or you're with your best friend. I mean, so adventure is getting on your bike and maybe taking a map and figuring out how to get to the next place using a map. It's really just getting outside your comfort zone and then enjoying it.
That's author Caroline Paul speaking with KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs. Her new book is called Gutsy Girl, Escapes for Your Life of Epic Adventure. And you can bring your daughters and sons to hear some of Caroline Paul's adventures firsthand. She'll be reading at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park tonight at 7 o'clock. Whether you're a gutsy outdoors person, or if you prefer to spend your Saturdays in libraries, you should subscribe to our podcast. You can hear Cross Currents when you want and catch up on past episodes. You can even search by subject. Find out how at kalw.org/subscribe. Our team includes Lisa Bartfy, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Angela Johnston, Truk Nguyen, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Jeremy Dalmas. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by San Francisco band The Spiral Electric. They play Bottom of the Hill in San Francisco on Thursday evening. Show starts at 8:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.